They walked in single file. The entrance to the path was like a sort of arch leading into a gloomy tunnel made by two great trees that leant together, too old and strangled with ivy and hung with lichen to bear more than a few blackened leaves. The path itself was narrow and wound in and out among the trunks. Soon, the light at the gate was like a little bright hole far behind, and the quiet was so deep that their feet seemed to thump along while all the trees leant over them and listened. As their eyes became used to the dimness, they could see a little way to either side in a sort of darkened green glimmer. Occasionally, a slender beam of sun that had the luck to slip in through some opening in the leaves far above, and still more luck in not being caught in the tangled boughs and matted twigs beneath, stabbed down, thin and bright before them. But this was seldom, and it soon ceased altogether. There were black squirrels in the wood. As Bilbo's sharp, inquisitive eyes got used to seeing things, he could catch glimpses of them, whisking off the path and scuttling behind tree trunks. There were queer noises too, grunts, scufflings and hurryings in the undergrowth and among the leaves that lay piled endlessly thick in places on the forest floor. But what made the noises, he could not see. The nastiest things they saw were the cobwebs, dark, dense cobwebs with threads extraordinarily thick, often stretched from tree to tree or tangled in the lower branches on either side of them. There were none stretched across the path, but whether because some magic kept it clear, or for what other reason, they could not guess. It was not long before they grew to hate the forest as heartily as they had hated the tunnels of the goblins, and it seemed to offer even less hope of any ending. But they had to go on and on, long after they were sick for a sight of the sun and of the sky, and longed for the feel of the wind on their faces. There was no movement of air down under the forest roof, and it was everlastingly still and dark and stuffy. Even the dwarves felt it, who were used to tunnelling, and live at times for long whiles without the light of the sun. But the hobbit, who liked holes to make a house in, but not to spend summer days in, felt that he was being slowly suffocated. The nights were the worst. It then became pitch dark, not what you call pitch dark, but really pitch, so black that you really could see nothing. Bilbo tried flapping his hand in front of his nose, but he could not see it at all. Well, perhaps it's not true to say that they could see nothing. They could see eyes. They slept all closely huddled together and took it in turns to watch. And when it was Bilbo's turn, he would see gleams in the darkness around them. And sometimes pairs of yellow or red or green eyes would stare at him from a little distance and then slowly fade and disappear and slowly shine out again in another place. And sometimes they would gleam down from the branches just above him. And that was the most terrifying. But the eyes that he liked the least were horrible, pale, bulbous sort of eyes. Insect eyes, he thought, not animal eyes, only they are much too big. Although it was not yet very cold, they tried lighting watchfires at night, but soon gave that up. It seemed to bring hundreds and hundreds of eyes all around them, though the creatures, whatever they were careful never to let their bodies show in the little flicker of the flames. Worse still, it brought thousands of dark grey and black moths, some nearly as big as your hand, flapping and whirring round their ears. They could not stand that, nor the huge bats, black as a top hat either, so they gave up fires and sat at night and dozed in the enormous, uncanny darkness. All this went on for what seemed to the hobbit ages upon ages, and he was always hungry, for they were extremely careful with their provisions. Even so, as days followed days, and still the forest seemed just the same, they began to get anxious. The food would not last forever. It was, in fact, already beginning to get low. They tried shooting at the squirrels, and they wasted many arrows before they managed to bring one down at the path. But when they roasted it, it proved horrible to taste, and they shot no more squirrels. They were thirsty too, for they had none too much water, and in all the time they had seen yet neither spring nor stream. This was their state when one day they found their path blocked by a running water. It flowed fast and strong, but not very wide right across the way, and it was black, or looked it in the gloom. It was well that Bjorn had warned them against it, or they would have drunk from it, whatever its colour, and filled some of their emptied skins at the bank. As it was, they only thought of how to cross it without wetting themselves in its water. There had been a bridge of wood across it, but it had rotted and fallen, leaving only the broken posts near the bank. Bilbo, kneeling on the brink and peering forward, cried, "There's a boat against the far bank. Now why couldn't it have been on this side?" "How far away do you think it is?" asked Thorin. for by now they knew Bilbo had the sharpest eyes among them. "Not at all far. I should think about 12 yards."
12 yards? I should have thought it was 30 at least. But my eyes don't see as well as they used to 100 years ago. Still, 12 yards is as good as a mile. We can't jump it, and we daren't try to wade or swim.
Can any of you throw rope?
What's the good of that? The boat is sure to be tied up, even if we could hook it, which I doubt.
I don't believe it is tied, said Bilbo, though of course I can't be sure in this light, but it looks to me as if it was just drawn up on the bank, which is low where the path goes down into the water.
Dorry is the strongest, but Filly is the youngest and still has the best sight, said Thorin.
Come here, Filly, and see if you can see the boat Mr. Baggins here is talking about.
Filly thought he could, so when he'd stared a long while to get an idea of the direction, the others brought him a rope. They had several with them, and on the end of the longest they fastened one of the large iron hooks they had used for catching their packs to the straps about their shoulders. Filly took this in his hand, balanced it for a moment, and then flung it across the stream. Splash! It fell in the water.
Not far enough, said Bilbo, who was peering forward. A couple of feet and you would have dropped it onto the boat. Try again. I don't suppose the magic is strong enough to hurt you if you just touch a bit of wet rope.
Filly picked up the hook when he had drawn it back, rather doubtfully all the same. This time he threw it with greater strength.
Steady, said Bilbo. You've thrown it right into the wood on the other side. Draw it back gently.
Filly hauled the rope back slowly, and after a while Bilbo said, Carefully, carefully, it's lying on the boat. Let's hope the hook will catch.
It did.
The rope went taut, and Filly pulled in vain. Keeley came to his help, and then Owen and Glowin. They tugged and tugged, and suddenly they all fell over on their backs. Bilbo was on the lookout and caught the rope, and with a little piece of stick fended off the little black boat as it came rushing across the stream.
Help!
He shouted, and Balin was just in time to seize the boat before it floated off down the current.
It was tied after all, said he, looking at the snapped painter that was still dangling from it. That was a good pull, my lads, and a good job that our rope was the stronger.
Who'll cross first? Asked Bilbo.
I shall, said Thorin, and you will come with me, and Filly and Balin, and that's as many as the boat will hold at a time. After that, Killy and Owen and Glowin and Dorry. Next, Ori and Norri, Biffa and Boffa, and last, Dwalin and Bomba.
I'm always last, and I don't like it, said Bomba. It's somebody else's turn today.
You should not be so fat. As you are, you must be with the last and lightest boatload. Don't start grumbling against orders, or something bad will happen to you.
There aren't any oars. How are you going to push the boat back to the far bank? Asked the Hobbit.
Give me another length of rope and another hook, said Filly.
And when they got it ready, he cast it into the darkness ahead and as high as he could throw it. Since it did not fall down again, they saw that it must have stuck in the branches.
Get in now, said Filly, and one of you haul on the rope that's stuck in a tree on the other side.
One of the others must keep hold of the hook we used at first, and when we are safe on the other side, he can hook it on and you can draw the boat back. In this way, they were all soon on the far bank, safe across the enchanted stream. Dwalin had just come scrambling out with the coiled rope on his arm, and Bomba, still grumbling, was getting ready to follow, when something bad did happen. There was a flying sound of hooves on the path ahead. Out of the gloom came suddenly the shape of a flying deer. It charged into the dwarves and bowled them over, then gathered itself for a leap. High it sprang and cleared the water with a mighty jump, but it did not reach the other side in safety. Thorin was the only one who had kept his feet and his wits. As soon as they'd landed, he had bent his bow and fitted an arrow in case any hidden guardian of the boat appeared. Now he sent a swift and sure shot into the leaping beast. As it reached the further bank, it stumbled. The shadow swallowed it up, but they heard the sound of hooves quickly falter and then go still. Before they could shout in praise of the shot, however, a dreadful wail from Bilbo put all thoughts of venison out of their mind.
Bomba has fallen in! Bomba is drowning! He cried.
It was only too true. Bomba had only one foot on the land when the Hart bore down on him and sprang over him. He had stumbled, thrusting the boat away from the bank, and then toppled back into the dark water, his hands slipping off the slimy roots at the edge, while the boat spun slowly off and disappeared. They could see his hood above the water when they ran to the bank. Quickly, they flung a rope with a hook towards him. His hand caught it, and they pulled him to the shore. He was drenched from hair to boots, of course, but that was not the worst. When they'd laid him on the bank, he was already fast asleep, with one hand clutching the rope so tight they could not get it from his grasp. And fast asleep he remained, in spite of all they could do. They were still standing over him, cursing their ill luck and Bomber's clumsiness and lamenting the loss of the boat, which made it impossible for them to go back and look for the heart, when they became aware of the dim blowing of horns in the wood and the sound of dogs baying far off. They all fell silent, and as they sat, it seemed they could hear the noise of a great hunt going by to the north of the path, though they saw no sign of it. There they sat for a long while and did not dare make a move. Bomber slept on with a smile on his fat face, as if he no longer cared for all the troubles that vexed them. Suddenly, on the path ahead, appeared some white deer, a hind and fawns as snowy white as the heart had been dark. They glimmered in the shadows. Before Thorin could cry out, three of the dwarves had leapt to their feet and loosed off arrows from their bows. None seemed to find their mark. The deer turned and vanished in the trees as silently as they had come, and in vain the dwarves shot their arrows after them. "Stop! Stop!" shouted Thorin, but it was too late. The excited dwarves had wasted their last arrows, and now the bows that Bjorn had given them were useless. They were a gloomy party that night, and the gloom gathered still deeper on them in the following days. They had crossed the enchanted stream, but beyond it the path seemed to straggle on just as before, and in the forest they could see no change. Yet if they had known more about it and considered the meaning of the hunt and the white deer that appeared on their path, they would have known that they were at last drawing towards the eastern edge and would soon have come, if they could have kept up their courage and their hope, to thinner trees and places where sunlight came again. But they did not know this, and they were burdened with the heavy body of Bomber, which they had to carry along with them as best they could, taking the wearisome task in turns of four each, while the others shared their packs. If these had not become all too light in the last few days, they would never have managed it, but a slumbering and smiling Bomber was a poor exchange for packs filled with food, however heavy. In a few days, a time came when there was practically nothing left to eat or to drink. Nothing wholesome could they see growing in the woods, only funguses and herbs with pale leaves and unpleasant smells. About 4 days from the enchanted stream, they came to a part where most of the trees were beeches. They were at first inclined to be cheered by the change, for here there was no undergrowth and the shadow was not so deep. There was a greenish light about them, and in places they could see some distance to either side of the path. Yet the light only showed them endless lines of straight grey trunks like the pillars of some huge twilight hall. There was a breath of air and a noise of wind, but it had a sad sound. A few leaves came rustling down to remind them that outside autumn was coming on. Their feet ruffled among the dead leaves of countless other autumns that drifted over the banks of the path from the deep red carpets of the forest. Still, Bomber slept, and they grew very, very weary. At times they heard disquieting laughter. Sometimes it was singing in the distance too. The laughter was the laughter of fair voices, not of goblins, and the singing was beautiful. But it sounded eerie and strange, and they were not comforted. Rather, they hurried on from these parts with what strength they had. 2 days later, they found their path going downwards, and before long they were in a valley filled almost entirely with a mighty growth of oaks. "Is there no end to this accursed forest?" said Thorin. "Somebody must climb a tree and see if he can get his head above the roof and have a look around. The only way is to choose the tallest tree that overhangs the path." Of course, somebody meant Bilbo. They chose him because to be of any use the climber must get his head above the topmost leaves, and so he must be light enough for the highest and slenderest branches to bear him. Poor Mr. Baggins had never had much practice in climbing trees, but they hoisted him up into the lowest branches of an enormous oak that grew right out into the path, and he had to go up as best he could. He pushed his way through the tangled twigs with many a slap in the eye. He was greened and grimed from the old bark of the greater boughs, and more than once he slipped and caught himself just in time. At last, after a dreadful struggle in a difficult place where there seemed to be no convenient branches at all, he got near the top. All the time he was wondering whether there were spiders in the tree and how he was going to get down again, except by falling. In the end, he poked his head above the roof of leaves, and then he found spiders all right. But there were only small ones of ordinary size, and they were after the butterflies. Bilbo's eyes were nearly blinded by the light. He could hear the dwarf shouting up at him from far below. But he could not answer, only hold on and blink. The sun was shining brilliantly, and it was a long while before he could bear it. When he could, he saw all around him a sea of dark green, ruffled here and there by the breeze, and there were everywhere hundreds of butterflies. I expect they were a kind of purple emperor, a butterfly that loves the tops of oak woods, but these were not purple at all. They were a dark, dark, velvety black, without any markings to be seen.
He looked at the Black Empress for a long time and enjoyed the feel of the breeze in his hair and on his face, but at length the cries of the dwarves, who were now simply stamping with impatience down below, reminded him of his real business. It was no good. Gaze as they might, he could see no end to the trees and the leaves in any direction. His heart, that had been lightened by the sight of the sun and the feel of the wind, sank back into his toes, and there was no food to go back down to below. Actually, as I have told you, they were not far off the edge of the forest, and if Bilbo had had the sense to see it, the tree that he had climbed, though it was tall in itself, was standing near the bottom of a wide valley, so that from its top the tree seemed to swell up around like the edges of a great bowl, and he could not expect to see how far the forest lasted. Still, he did not see this, and he climbed down full of despair. He got to the bottom again at last, scratched, hot and miserable, and he could not see anything in the gloom below when he got there. His report soon made the others as miserable as he was.
"The forest goes on forever and ever in all directions. Whatever shall we do? And what is the use of sending a hobbit?" they cried, as if it was all his fault. They did not care a tuppence about the butterflies, and were only made more angry when he told them of the beautiful breeze, which they were too heavy to climb up and feel. That night, they ate their very last scraps and crumbs of food, and next morning when they awoke, the first thing they noticed was that they were still gnawingly hungry, and the next thing was that it was raining, and that here and there the drip of it was dropping heavily on the forest floor. That only reminded them that they were also parchingly thirsty. Without doing anything to relieve them, you cannot quench a terrible thirst by standing under giant oaks and waiting for a chance drip to fall on your tongue. The only scrap of comfort there was came unexpectedly from Bomba. He woke up suddenly and sat up, scratching his head. He could not make out where he was at all, nor why he felt so hungry, for he'd forgotten everything that had happened since they started their journey that May morning long ago. The last thing that he remembered was the party at the Hobbit's house, and they had great difficulty in making him believe their tales of all the many adventures they had had since. When he heard that there was nothing to eat, he sat down and wept, for he felt very weak and wobbly in the legs.
"Why did I ever wake up?" he cried. "I was having such a beautiful dreams. I dreamt I was walking in a forest rather like this one, only lit with torches on the trees and lamps swinging from the branches and fires burning on the ground. And there was a great feast going on forever. A woodland king was there with a crown of leaves, and there was a merry singing, and I could not count or describe the things that there were to eat and drink."
"You need not try," said Thorin. "In fact, if you can't talk about something else, you'd better be silent. We are quite annoyed enough with you as it is. If you hadn't waked up, we should have left you to your idiotic dreams in the forest. You're no joke to carry, even after weeks of short commons." There was nothing now to be done but to tighten the belts around their empty stomachs and hoist their empty sacks and packs and trudge along the track without any great hope of ever getting to the end before they laid down and died of starvation. This they did all that day, going very slowly and wearily, while Bomba kept on wailing that his legs would not carry him and that he wanted to lie down and sleep. "No, you don't," they said. "Let your legs take their share. We've carried you far enough." All the same, he suddenly refused to go a step further and flung himself on the ground.
"Go on if you must," he said. "I'm just going to lie here and sleep and dream of food. If I can't get it any other way, I hope I never wake up again."
At that moment, Balin, who was a little way ahead, called out, "What was that? I thought I saw a twinkle of light in the forest." They all looked, and a longish way off, it seemed, they saw a red twinkle in the dark, and then another, and another sprang out beside it. Even Bomba got up. They hurried along, then not caring if it was trolls or goblins. The light was in front of them and to the left of the path, and when at last they'd drawn level with it, it seemed plain that torches and fires were burning under the trees, but a good way off their track.
"It looks as if my dreams were coming true,"
gasped Bomba, puffing up behind. He wanted to rush straight off into the woods after the lights, but the others remembered only too well the warnings of the wizard and of Beorn. "A feast would be no good if we never got back alive from it," said Thorin.
"But without a feast we shan't remain alive much longer anyway," said Bomba,
and Bilbo heartily agreed with him. They argued about it backwards and forwards for a long while, until they agreed at length to send out a couple of spies to creep near the lights and find out more about them.
But then they could not agree on who was to be sent. Nobody seemed anxious to run the chance of being lost and never finding his friends again. In the end, in spite of warnings, hunger decided them, because Bomber kept on describing all the good things that were being eaten, according to his dream in the woodland feast. So they all left the path and plunged into the forest together. After a good deal of creeping and crawling, they peered round the trunks and looked into a clearing where some trees had been felled and the ground levelled. There were many people there, elvish-looking folk, all dressed in green and brown and sitting on sawn rings of the felled trees in a great circle. There was a fire in their midst, and there were torches fastened to some of the trees round about. But most splendid of all, they were eating and drinking and laughing merrily. The smell of the roast meats was so enchanting that without waiting to consult one another, every one of them got up and scrambled forwards into the ring with the one idea of begging for some food. No sooner had the first stepped into the clearing than all the lights went out, as if by magic. Somebody kicked the fire and it went up in rockets of glittering sparks and vanished. They were lost in completely lightless darkness, and they could not even find one another, not for a long time at any rate. After blundering frantically in the gloom, falling over logs and bumping crash into trees and shouting and calling till they must have waked everything in the forest for miles, at last they managed to gather themselves in a bundle and count themselves by touch. By that time they had of course quite forgotten in what direction the path lay, and they were all hopelessly lost, at least till the morning. There was nothing for it but to settle down for the night where they were. They did not even dare to search on the ground for scraps of food for fear of becoming separated again, but they had not been lying long, and Bilbo was only just getting drowsy, when Dorry, whose turn it was to watch first, said in a loud whisper, "The lights are coming out again over there, and there are more than ever of them." Up they all jumped. There, sure enough, not far away, were scores of twinkling lights, and they heard the voices and the laughter quite plainly. They crept slowly towards them in a single line, each touching the back of the one in front. When they got near, Thorin said, "No rushing forward this time. No one is to stir from hiding till I say. I shall send Mr. Baggins alone first to talk to them. They won't be frightened of him." "What about me of them?" thought Bilbo. "And anyway, I hope they won't do anything nasty to him." When they got to the edge of the circle of lights, they pushed Bilbo suddenly from behind. Before he had time to slip on his ring, he stumbled forward into the full blaze of the fire and torches. It was no good. Out went all the lights again, and complete darkness fell. It had been difficult collecting themselves before. It was far worse this time, and they simply could not find the hobbit. Every time they counted themselves, it only made 13. They shouted and called, "Bilbo Baggins! Hobbit! You dratted hobbit! Hi, hobbit, confiscate you! Where are you?" And all the other things of this sort, but there was no answer. They were just giving up hope when Dorry stumbled across him by sheer luck. In the dark, he fell over what he thought was a log, and he found it was the hobbit curled up fast asleep. It took a deal of shaking to wake him, and when he was awake, he was not pleased at all. "I was having such a lovely dream," he grumbled, "all about having the most gorgeous dinner." "Good heavens, he's gone like Bomber," they said. "Don't tell us about dream dinners. Dream dinners aren't any good. We can't share them." "They're the best I'm likely to get in this beastly place," muttered Bilbo as he lay down beside the dwarfs and tried to go back to sleep and find his dream again. But that was not the last of the lights in the forest. Later, when the night must have been getting old, Killy, who was watching then, came and roused them all, saying, "There's a regular blaze of light begun not far away. Hundreds of torches and many fires must have been lit suddenly and by magic. And listen to the singing and the harps." After lying and listening for a while, they found they could not resist the desire to go nearer and try once more to get help. Up they got again, and this time the result was disastrous. The feast that they now saw was greater and more magnificent than before, and at the head of a long line of feasters sat a woodland king, with a crown of leaves upon his golden hair, very much as Bomber had described the figure in his dreams. The elvish folk were passing bowls from hand to hand across the fire, and some were harping, and many were singing. Their gleaming hair was twined with flowers. Green and white gems glinted on their collars and their belts and their faces, and their songs were filled with mirth. Loud and clear and fair were those songs, and out stepped Thorin into their midst. Dead silence fell in the middle of a word. Out went the lights. The fires leapt up in black smoke. Ashes and cinders were in the eyes of the dwarves, and the wood was filled again with their clamour and their cries. Bilbo found himself running round and round, as he thought, calling and calling, "Dorry, Norry, Orry, Owen, Glowin, Philly, Killy, Bomber, Biffa, Boffa, Dwalin and Barlin, Thorin, Oakenshield." while people he could not see or feel were doing the same all around him, with an occasional "Bilbo!" thrown in. But the cries of the others got steadily further and fainter, though after a while it seemed to him that they changed to yells and cries for help in the far distance. All noise at last died right away, and he was left alone in complete silence and darkness. This was one of his most miserable moments, but he soon made up his mind that it was no good trying to do anything till day came with some little light, and quite useless to go blundering about, tiring himself out with no hope of any breakfast to revive him. So he sat himself down with his back to a tree, and not for the last time fell to thinking of his far distant hobbit hole with its beautiful pantries. He was deep in thoughts of bacon and eggs and toast and butter when he felt something touch him. Something like a strong, sticky string was against his left hand, and when he tried to move, he found that his legs were already wrapped in the same stuff, so that when he got up, he fell down. Then the great spider, who had been busy tying him up while he dozed, came from behind him and came at him. He could only see the thing's eyes, but he could feel its hairy legs as it struggled to wind its abominable threads round and round him. It was lucky that he came to his senses in time. Soon he would not have been able to move at all. As it was, he had a desperate fight before he got free. He beat the creature off with his hands as it was trying to poison him to keep him quiet, as small spiders do to flies, until he remembered his sword and drew it out. Then the spider jumped back and he had time to cut his legs loose. After that, it was Bilbo's turn to attack. The spider evidently was not used to things that carried such stings at their sides, or it would have hurried away quicker. Bilbo came at it before it could disappear and struck it with his sword right in the eyes. Then it went mad and leapt and danced and flung out its legs in horrible jerks until he killed it with another stroke. And then he fell down and remembered nothing more for a long while. There was a usual dim grey light of the forest day about him when he came to his senses. The spider lay dead beside him, and his sword blade was stained black. Somehow the killing of the giant spider, all alone by himself in the dark, without the help of the wizard or the dwarves or of anyone else, made a great difference to Mr. Baggins. He felt a different person, and much fiercer and more bold in spite of an empty stomach. As he wiped his sword on the grass and put it back into his sheath, he said, "I will give you a name. I will call you Sting."